Morning this evening. Mr. Dennis Helseth, or Roger Helburn, Seals, Peter Glazer, and Mr. Gronzo. I believe Mr. Lombard is here. If you'd like to go ahead, I don't know if you're coordinating a testimony with the representatives from Alexander and Alexander Marsh McLennan. If so, please feel free to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Kip Lombard, here representing the Seals organization. So we have several issues that we were going to discuss tonight that did not have an opportunity to get to last night. I think the first one that I'm going to take in order is Jeff Johnson to talk about collateral source benefits. As
sure.
The committee knows, there were no provisions in the majority bill in 323C regarding collateral source benefits. I'm handing to the committee in LC draft form what was Section 13A of Senate Bill 323B, the Brenneman-Brockman Minority Report, covering our proposal, the SEALS proposal, on how to handle collateral source benefits. So I'm submitting this in the form of proposed amendments.
Great. We'll ask those
I'll
to
ask
distribute it.
Mr. Johnson to.
Good idea.
Evening.
Good evening.
Thank you for having me back this evening. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk on an important subject of collateral sources. I'm Jeff Johnson. I'm a Portland lawyer. I've been here before. I work with the law firm of Cosgrave, Kester, Crow, Gidley, and Laugesen, and I'm speaking tonight on behalf of the Legislative Subcommittee of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel, which is an association of attorneys representing individuals, private companies who are self-insurers, and private insurers who are defendants in civil litigation in which claims for damages are made against them. And I'm speaking in support of Senate Bill 323C and specifically Section 13A, the collateral source benefits rule. My testimony will be brief. I just want to cover five areas. One is to just generally explain what the collateral source rule is. Two, talk about some of the inequitable results that flow from that rule. Three, the economic effect on insurance, which I know this committee is keenly interested in. Four, what is happening around the country. And five, lastly, how this bill addresses and solves the problems that we perceive that exist. The collateral source rule was actually a judicially created creature in 1855, and the rule basically says that benefits which are received by a plaintiff from a collateral source that is wholly independent of the defendant will not diminish damages otherwise recoverable from a defendant. Real good examples are medical and health benefits and continued salary and wage payments. The rationale in the mid-1800s was that the defendant deserves the pay, and if there must be a windfall, it better be better that it go to the injured person than it go to the wrongdoer. And at the time that rule was created, it did make some sense because there weren't a whole lot of collateral benefits available in the mid-1800s. But the effect of this rule in today's society has been to give the plaintiffs a windfall and significantly double recovery for the plaintiff and double payment potentially by a defendant. For example, if Smith is injured at the residence of Jones due to Jones's negligence, as a result of the injury, Smith's medical bills are paid under Jones's homeowner's insurance policy. Smith subsequently sues Jones, seeking to recover for the same medical bills that were already paid under Jones's homeowner's insurance policy. Under current Oregon law, Jones, at the trial of Smith versus Jones, may not introduce evidence that his insurance company has already partially paid for the same medical bills that are now being claimed a second time by Smith. This is true even though Smith has no obligation to repay those benefits that he has already received from Jones's insurance company. This amounts to a double recovery to Smith at the expense of Jones, who paid the insurance premiums that are the source of both payments. Another example is the case of Henderson versus Hercules, which is a Oregon Court of Appeals case, 57 ORAP 791, in which a fellow was working and was injured trying to escape an explosion at one of the defendant's chemical storage tanks. He had a contract with another party for his wages, and he was able to enforce that contract and recover for his lost wages from Portland Terminal Railroad is who it was. At the same time, he was able to recover his wage loss against the defendant, Hercules Incorporated, who was the party claimed to have been negligent. What this amounted to for the plaintiff was he gets paid twice for his wages, and as this case points out, Portland Terminal Company intended to sue the defendant to recoup its losses. So, in effect, both the plaintiff in that case gets double recovery, and the potential at least exists that the defendant has to pay twice. Since the purpose of the tort law is to make the plaintiff or the injured party whole, that is to award full compensation, that purpose is to provide them no more but no less than full compensation, and the collateral source rule frustrates that system. It's significant, I think, to note that it discriminates against the poor and the unemployed who generally do not have the money to have collateral source benefits. For example, if you have a, I think it's for the sake of time, I'll not get into some examples. I think that the economic effect of the collateral source rule has been studied, and I will say at the outset that I don't have hard data dealing with the Oregon experience. I know that Representative Hanlon was particularly interested in that last night, and we don't have that. What we do have, however, is a 1979 study that showed that 79% of all claimants had at least one collateral source. And we also have statistics that demonstrate that for the average claimant was compensated $1.40 for every $1 of economic loss, and that same study showed that in some cases, and I can't quantify the number, but in some classes, the compensation actually received went as high as almost $4 for every $1 of actual hard economic loss. And I think it doesn't need to much explanation to show that when you're paying more than $1 for $1 loss, you're going to have to spread that someplace, and I think that has a direct impact on insurance rates and insurance availability and affordability. The trend nationally has been to abolish the collateral source rule. 20 states have passed laws eliminating it in medical malpractice. In 1986, Colorado and Illinois significantly restricted it. In 1986, Connecticut, Florida, Indiana, and Minnesota abolished.
20 states on Med-Mal?
On Med-Mal.
Okay. Now, the Illinois and Colorado?
Illinois and Colorado, they restricted it. And frankly, I can't tell you exactly what they did.
Was it Med-Mal they restricted it?
No. The statistics that I have do not. We have Med-Mal is 20.
Okay.
And those states. Now, whether those states, I know that Colorado and Illinois are, I know that Colorado is not in the 20 that I listed. Illinois is.
Okay.
And Connecticut, Florida, Indiana, and Minnesota abolished the collateral source rule in all civil litigation. Judicially, it's been criticized, although it is a very vital rule in this particular state. Now, Senate Bill 323C, Section 13, is frankly a compromise. If we had our druthers, we'd rather have a jury hear everything that's going on with this particular plaintiff. That is, evidence of collateral sources would be admissible at trial. This bill, as it currently is drafted, does not permit that. Plaintiff is entitled to plead and prove all damages which they have received without regard to what collateral source that they may fall back upon. But what the bill also says that if the plaintiff is obligated to repay the collateral source benefit, then in that event, the rule does not apply. if the plaintiff paid for the benefit, that is, paid for a premium, or, for example, you work for a period of time and you get sick leave or any type of credit for time served, there is an allowance in there for him or her to get credit for the benefit that they've received. And there is going to be a hearing on that particular area to quantify the amount of offset or credit, if you will, that the person who earned the benefit would receive. Life insurance is not subject to this deduction. We think that the statute is broadly written to cover most any collateral source that may exist, and frankly, your imagination can kind of run wild on that particular area. But what it does do is it stops the windfall, it stops the double recovery, it stops the double payment, and it should have a direct and immediate effect on insurance rates.
Representative Dix.
You gave offered an interesting perspective of Jones, who has to pay for the bill and the medicine and then is sued for the same thing that Jones just had to pay for and ends up paying for it twice. What about the guy who's bought a policy to cover himself, some kind of disability policy to cover himself? He's paid on it for 15 years, money that came out of his family budget for 15 years because he made that decision. Something happens to him. You then, in that situation, want the jury to know that he already has a disability policy. Is that correct?
Well, ideally, I guess from our perspective, the answer to that is yes. However, this bill does not do that. The jury will not hear it. The court will, after there has been a determination of liability. The person that has, and that could be me, that has paid money out of my own pocket for that disability benefit, should get a credit for the out-of-pocket out-of-pocket expenses that it cost to purchase that policy, and this bill addresses that by taking that into account.
A credit for the, I'm sorry,
for the premiums or the premium dollar that it paid to purchase the disability insurance and to receive the benefits under that policy.
So it's really not to anyone's advantage to buy that policy.
Well, I think it still is, because it would not be to your advantage if you're a prevailing party in a civil litigation and you are able to make an actual recovery. And that's really only when this rule really becomes effective, and that is that there's been a determination of liability of the defendant, that he's entitled, or him or her entitled to recovery for loss of wages, for example, for which the disability policy would cover, and only the court's going to hear it, and they're going to have a hearing and to quantify the credit that person is rightfully entitled to.
But if that person has taken on the responsibility of providing for his family by purchasing enough insurance to cover his family, and an accident occurs, you're saying that person is to be penalized and not recover the money anyone else would who didn't have those policies. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, I guess I have to go back to the premise of the question. There's a lot of reasons why you'd want to take out a disability policy, and it might be totally unrelated to the tort system.
I understand.
So putting that aside, the person that does buy a disability policy does buy them some protection, again, in the event that their civil litigation
fails.
In the event that they prevail, they don't get double recovery. They get single recovery, but they get credit for their actual out-of-pocket expenses.
Why is it any of the, in that particular action, why is that the court's business what that person has done prior to the litigation being, prior to the action being taken? If that person's paid on a policy for 15 years, why is that the court's business when a person has been damaged over the course of the last year, the 16th year on the policy, for instance? Why would you bring in the fact at that point that this person has this disability policy?
Well, again, the context in which that would occur would be after a determination of liability, so we're going to determine exactly how much money is going to change hands.
Right.
I think it's important to the injured person to have that the court know about it, because what that means is that they get paid back, if you will, for out-of-pocket expenses paid to purchase the policy. So it's really, it's fair to the injured party to have that kind of hearing.
But almost every case that, that takes me, if I just...
Don't take a lot of the committee stuff.
Almost every case that, and I don't know this for a fact, it's a generalization, but usually people ask for a lot more than they ever get either in settlement or a verdict. And many times the average plaintiff, I would imagine, doesn't feel that they got a good deal. And this would just supplement. I mean, you presented as if this, you used the words windfall. You presented as if, I don't know, and perhaps this isn't your meaning, but it, what I conjure up when you say that is that there are a hell of a lot of cases out there where people receive this windfall because they have two or three insurance policies. Is that the case?
In my experience, it's not in every case, but it is in a lot of cases in which a very good example. Let's take a state employee has these bargain for benefits, is involved in an automobile accident and misses work for a month. Well, under the sick leave benefits that they've earned, they get $1,500 a month, say, salary. Mm-hmm. And then they may bring an action and they properly plead and prove that they're off work as a result of these injuries and suffered an out-of-pocket loss of $1,500. So when they, after the case is over under the present system, they get the $1,500 that they received by virtue of their bargain for benefits, and they also receive an additional $1,500 from the defendant for a total of $3,000. This proposal would not allow that, but what it would take into account if it through the system that is established in the bill, the court would hear evidence as to the cost to the claimant to receive the bargain for benefit of sick leave benefits. So there's a basically a credit that they're working with there, and it does happen.
No, I'm sure it happens. I guess it's a.
This is made.
I guess our differences are that, and you and I probably will agree to disagree on this, that person may have spent 10 years of their life accruing that sick leave, and you want to take it away from them and not hold your client liable in that situation for those economic. In other words, essentially, in that case, if someone's already covered, why should the insurance company you're representing have to cover them in a liable case?
Well, there are two points to that. One is that the bill does say that before making any deduction, the court shall determine the cost to the plaintiff or plaintiff's estate of obtaining such benefit and shall credit the cost against the amount of the benefit to be deducted from the judgment. So what they earned is what they're entitled to.
Well, what if it's just 10 years of time on the job? How do they credit that to accrue that sick leave?
There must be some formula that most companies have, and I mean, I know that for fact, and certainly within the state system, which is a real example close to everyone's heart, is that there is a way of making that type of determination. But secondly, I guess the question, though, is an economic one, too, and that is that if this person gets basically double recovery, that's an added cost to the entire system, because the whole premise of tort liability and insurance is spreading of a loss throughout society to be sure that the injured party is adequately compensated, but also to spread the cost. And this is one area of the tort system where
Could you repeat that last sentence again? I missed it. The last sentence you said. I missed that.
My point is simply that the tort system is and the insurance system is designed at least to spread the loss throughout society, if you will. I mean, using very big theoretical terms, and what we have here is you've got, if you will, the state being the employer, is paying out $1,500 in loss benefits, and then you also have an insurance company, or for that matter, somebody who's not insured is paying an additional $1,500, and so the system basically is paying twice for double salary for, say, one month's worth of work.
I had an injury when I was younger, and I had purchased two health policies. One was through a university, and the university policy, they told me I could spend the money in whatever way I wanted to, that it didn't necessarily have to go to pay for my health benefits. And they sold me the policy. They gave me cash instead of paying the hospital, which a lot of firms do. They will pay you a lump sum for whatever injury you have. Now, why should I have to go and pay my hospital bill when, in this particular accident, the person was liable and I had paid for that insurance policy for whatever reason? And you and I know we can go down and buy six or seven insurance policies on anything we want and pay, you know, forever on them. And if an instance comes up and we've been paying, we want the money in that circumstance, and that's what the insurance company is taking the gamble on, is that we won't have that particular accident. That's why they base their rates the way they do. But when an accident occurs, what you're suggesting is that the person liable shouldn't have to pay anything if it's already covered after the decision has been made that there is liability.
No, I really don't think you and I are agreeing to disagree. I think we both are. I think we both agree. The wrongdoer should ought to pay, but pay once. The injured party ought to be compensated, but compensated once. The injured party ought to get some credit for the years of service or the out-of-pocket expenses of paying the premium dollar, and the bill provides for that. It's a pretty, in my opinion, it's a pretty fair resolution to a real, very real problem.
No, but that covers the Jones situation that you suggested. But what happens to the person who has the five insurance policies? Aren't you going to suggest at that point that the person's already covered under his present insurance policies, that he should be compensated for the amount of money he's put towards those insurance policies, period, and that's what the compensation should be? In other words, if he has paid premiums of $1,000 for six disability policies, that if you're held liable and he's covered for all his disability and his injuries and that's all he wants out of the deal, that you'll pay him the $1,000 for the premiums he's paid on those insurance policies. Being the liability, there's been liability. You're defending someone. The person over here has a disability policy. All he wants are his disability benefits or whatever. That's all he wants out of there. That's what he's suing for. You're going to come in and say you paid $1,000 for that disability insurance policy. It's worth $20,000. That's about what your disability. You already have a policy, sir. We will pay you $1,000 for the premiums you paid on that policy, and that's all we're going to do because you're compensated already. Isn't that the way the bill works?
Not precisely. Let's put it this way. In terms of as what happens between a disability carrier and,
I'm
say,
just using that as an example.
That's a good example as any to use, and that's not an infrequent situation. The disability carrier and the liability carrier will, from time, or even any other liability carrier, say the other fellow, the claimant has an insurance policy or auto policy and has received PIP benefits under that. It's very routine for the two PIP carriers to work out some kind of an arrangement as between the two as to who's going to pay for it. But the critical the point that I'm trying to make is that the injured party doesn't get any more than what that person's entitled to, no more but no less, and the party, the wrongdoer, whether they're insured or not, they have to pay their fair share out of the deal.
I don't see how that works. That's not what this bill does. Their fair share is in that case is the $1,000 of the premiums underneath the bill. It says the bill is. And that's what you've suggested here.
Well, there's a credit for the cost.
Compensated because he already has his own disability policy, and you're going to pay him, you're going to be nice enough to pay him for the premiums that he's paid over the last 10 years for that disability policy.
Well, let's take, for example, if there is an obligation on the part of the, say the disability carrier has a lien right to recover its out-of-pocket expenses in the event that the injured party recovers in a lawsuit. In that event, there would be an obligation to repay the disability carrier. And in that event, there is no obligation, this rule would not apply in that situation.
Run that by me again.
Okay.
Your liability carrier would pay the disability carrier?
What I'm saying is that if in the event that there is an obligation to repay,
right.
That is the injured party has to repay his own insurance carrier for benefits that he paid for on his premium, the collateral source, this bill would not touch that situation because he's got a duty to pay. So it's entirely proper for the wrongdoer to have to pay the whole tab.
Even if you had a disability policy?
Even if there's an obligation to repay, that's correct.
But who he would pay that to the plaintiff?
The wrongdoer would pay it to the plaintiff, and then the plaintiff would be obligated to reimburse his disability carrier. Sometimes it doesn't always work out that way. There's direct payment by one carrier to the other.
That's where we disagree.
Okay.
And it's just I have a fundamental problem, and I've tried to keep an open mind. And I know people in the audience will think this is a joke, but I've tried to keep an open mind in every facet of tort reform. I have the most difficult time with collateral source, and I find those who in many instances want government to get out of their lives, I find it unbelievable that they would come in and argue that in a court situation that your personal life is up for grabs over the last 20 years with regard to what you provided for in terms of insurance for your family. If you're liable, it's none of the court's business or this country's business what you've done in your family setting to provide for your family. You should be held liable and you should pay that plaintiff. And that's the problem I have. The last comment is, Mr. Johnson, and you probably know this, or may not, maybe you won't agree, the judicial system is a discriminating system against those who don't have money, period. And that's just the way it is.
That's in a sense what I was talking about last Wednesday on the G.I. Joe's case, if you will. But I don't necessarily disagree with what you're saying in part.
I mean, I think that perhaps this issue discriminates against those who don't have the ability to go out and purchase extra insurance, but the system itself discriminates against those who aren't as financially well off as some other people in our society. They have the ability to hire better counsel than those who have money have the ability to hire what we might think is better counsel in some instances than those who don't have money and have to have an indigent defense counsel appointed for them, that kind of thing. So,
well, briefly on that point, again, in terms of philosophical approach towards government and the conflict between the issue which this committee is struggling with of availability and affordability of insurance, what we're simply saying is that this particular provision of collateral source should have a direct impact on those issues. Now, whether the solution to the big problem of liability insurance conflicts with your perceived role of government in intervention in your lives, I think that's a difficult issue. But I don't necessarily agree with your view on that. But I respect your opinion. But I think that this is a rational, fair attempt to avoid double recovery for somebody, regardless of how much foresight that they may have, and again, double payment by somebody who may be insured, but by the same token may not be insured.
See, if a person has 14 policies and he has the misfortune to be hurt in a liability situation and there's liability to be found, as far as I'm concerned, that person ought to collect 14 times, and that's where we differ.
Mm-hmm. Let's
just put that up front.
So. I think that's fair.
Representative Phillips.
How would this system work? He injures me, I sue him, and get the court or the jury determines that he owes me. Then I come before the judge and lay out an affidavit for all the insurance policies and everything that I would be receiving because of this?
Again, the jury will never hear this in terms of the liability side of it. It's basically a post-judgment hearing, if you will. And if you have received benefits that have, if you will, carried you through
from the time of the injury to when you get your day in court, the court would hear that and determine whether or not the interest of the company that has already paid you benefits is such that they're entitled, they have a lien right, if you will, to recover their fair share out of that. They're going to hear that, or the court is, and they're also going to hear from you what it costs you to get that benefit. But that's going to be after the fact, so there's going to be perhaps a deduction from the overall cash that they're going to put into your pocket as a result of this lawsuit.
If I receive a $50,000 award for round figure purposes, and in between that period of time, my health insurance carrier has paid out $10,000 worth of benefits on a package that I purchased. And then, so I get the award of $50,000. You're going to subtract the already received $10,000. Is the company, or in this case, this guy who injures me, going to have to repay that insurance carrier the $10,000 that they paid?
That depends upon the nature of the coverage. And whatever rights that they may have, either under that policy or other, or by statute, if there's an obligation to repay by the injured party, this comes out of the $50,000. Then, in that event, the collateral source benefit statute would not be triggered.
Okay. Then, in this case, and I think this is right, you guys check me. The legislature pays for our health insurance, and I don't think we contribute to that. Well, we might. It's free, I think, no, something like
it's
that.
It's not free. It costs $118 a month for a single person, plus upward.
Okay, let's pretend, then, for purposes of clarity, that the employer pays it.